Welcome to week two of mindfulness with a Jewish flavor. Hope everyone's had a good day. And in case you haven't had a good day, it really shouldn't matter, because by now you've now learned the ability to let go of the past and be fully present in the now and with the freshness of the moment and being mindful of the infinite opportunity that exists in every moment, right? It's not that simple, but we'll work on it. So we're working on mindfulness, understanding what it is, how to experience it, how to practice it. We defined mindfulness last week, the short definition, as the process of attending to the present moment experience in a non-judgmental way. It's that second part that we're going to focus on tonight, more than the first part. But just do a little bit of review before we start. I'm going to just spend a few minutes reviewing what we did last week so we're up to date. We covered a number of concepts last week. First one being the beginner's mind. The beginner's mind is a big concept in mindfulness. A concept that the freshness of every moment, as we quoted from Dr. Kabat-Zinn, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the experts there are few. And from a Jewish point of view, we emphasized that greatly last week in talking about the idea of the concept that God recreates the universe every single moment, every single second. So every moment is indeed, truly, a fresh moment, a beginner's moment, a new moment, a moment of infinite opportunity where it doesn't matter what's happened in the past or what might happen in the future, but it's the opportunity of the moment, the opportunity of the now, that is important. Now, we spent a lot of time last week on a critical mindfulness concept, the concept of breathing. And we talked about why breathing is such a critical concept of mindfulness, because first of all, it's the essence of who we are. We do it all the time, and it's something we just cannot exist without. We talked about the idea of breathing being the one thing that we need for our existence, that we don't have to do anything for it. It's what we are. It's just what we do the whole time automatically. It's us. In other words, breathing expresses just who we are. We also talked about that the way we breathe, the way breathing takes place, sort of encapsulates the concept of mindfulness, of each moment being a distinct moment from the one before and the one after, that idea of the freshness of each moment, the beginner's mind, because breathing, although we do it continuously, it's not something that we do it in one long continuous experience, but it's more distinct moments of breathing in, then exhaling the toxicity of the breath that we took, and then starting again in a very, very fresh moment. So it's constant, but every breath is a fresh idea. Right. Then we went on to explain the neshama, the soul of breathing, and talked about the concept that in Hebrew, breathing is neshima and the soul is neshama. So in fact, when we breathe, it's the soul being expressed in each breath. So it's not just that we are aware of our breathing, but becoming aware of breathing and doing breathing exercises, which there are many in the mindfulness literature, but becoming aware of our breathing actually means, on a deeper level, becoming aware of the soul that's being expressed by the breath and through the breath, or being housed by the breath, right? And on that level, at the end, we went into an exercise, which I want to just spend a few minutes reviewing because we sort of rushed it towards the end, and that's the Modei Ani prayer, that is the prayer of gratitude that's recited early in the morning. But I shared it with you in terms of how to do it in the morning in a mindfulness context of becoming aware of who we are, becoming aware of the breath, and becoming aware of the neshama, the soul, that's expressed through that breath. And just to run through it again, we broke down that sentence, and I'm just going to go through it. We talked about the exercise being that when we wake up in the morning, first of all, the concept is to remain still, not to rush. Not just to rush out of bed physically, but not to rush into the day mentally. We wake up in the morning, not to check our emails right away on the iPhone that's next to the bed, not to think about the meetings that we have to, not to think about the sorrows or the issues or the challenges that are lay ahead of us, but just to wake up slowly, to wake up remembering that we're alive, we're woken up, we're there, to lay still and then to sit up, as the code of Jewish law actually tells us to do, that before you get out of bed, we actually have to sit up and just remember, just be aware that we're breathing, be aware that we are actually alive, and to practice that concept of breathing. As I mentioned last week, most of us don't breathe correctly in the best of times. Breathing properly and being aware of our breathing is actually to breathe in deeply, to hold it there for a few minutes, and then to exhale slowly. Just to be aware of that rhythm. In other words, get up in the morning, just spend a few moments breathing with that rhythm, being aware of the rhythm of the distinct moments that follow, each one follows the other, and being aware of the neshama, the soul that's being expressed. And then to reflect on that and to become aware of that, to eternalize it through the recitation and through the reflection that goes through the words of the Madea Ani. I'm just going to review it a little bit. So we talked about, first of all, we start off with the words Madea Ani, which means I thankfully acknowledge. It's on the screen there, you can follow it along. It's the concept of gratitude, it's the concept of being aware. Ani, Ani means I am here. Just being aware of the fact that I'm here, I'm awake, I'm breathing. I acknowledge that it's a gift, it's the idea of gratitude, it's thankfully acknowledging. Then we go on to a phrase called Lefanecha, before you. It's a critical phrase. Because before you means that this moment that I'm here and the now that I experience, the awareness that I'm experiencing, I understand and I acknowledge that it's a fresh moment, it's a new opportunity because it's Lefanecha, it's before God, which means I'm not alone, I don't operate alone, I have a soul, which is a spark of the divine, as we explained last week. It's the neshama being expressed in the neshima, it's the soul being expressed in the breath. And it means that I'm not just here in a limited sense, but I'm here part of a much greater infinite reality, and therefore it makes that moment more powerful, more meaningful, holier, and with much greater infinite opportunity. And then we acknowledge that the Lefanecha, that being before you, is a Melech Chai B'Kayim. We talk about God as being the living and eternal King. He's in control. He gives us the infinite power. He's omnipresent, He's omnipotent, and He's giving us that freshness, that infinite opportunity that exists within every moment. And then we go on to say, Shehechazarta bi Nishmati, you have returned my soul. In other words, we acknowledge, or we try to get to the point that as we breathe, we become aware that it's the soul that's breathing. It's the soul that's actually being expressed within the breathing. The chemla, we understand it's compassion. We don't take it for granted. It's a new opportunity. It's a fresh start. It's a gift. And the final phrase is an amazing phrase, as we explained last week, Rabba Emunatecha, which literally means great is your faithfulness. But as the commentaries explain, it actually means that God has, it's not actually talking about the faith that we have in God, which is obviously an important concept, but it's actually the faith that God has in us, and that God believes in us, in the fact that He starts us every day, He gives us that new beginning every day, and He believes that we have the ability for every moment to actually experience it to the fullest, to be aware of the moment, to live in the moment, to maximize the potential, the infinite potential that's in every moment. So that's just a summary and a review of that formula, and the idea, of course, is to try and say it once in a while, but not just to say it. The idea is the awareness, the reflection, the thinking, the meditation of saying the words and stopping and thinking about it and internalizing it, so it becomes part of who we are. Okay. Just another concept we just touched on last week before we go into today's topic is that mindfulness is not an exercise. It's not doing. It's a state of being, which means although mindfulness has many exercises and the idea of these exercises is to practice it and to become aware of it, to internalize it, to experience it, but mindfulness is really a state of being. It's the concept which we try and develop, this awareness every single part of the day. It's about doing things mindfully, whatever we're doing. In fact, it might even be this concept of multitasking. There are some times that we do more than one thing at a time, but even those things we have to do in a mindful way and be fully present in what we're doing, and we're going to develop this a little bit later on. As I saw one article, there's a movement called ACT. I'm not sure what the acronym is, but it's a mindfulness movement where... Oh, there we are. Okay, there you are. It's a mindfulness process without meditation. The idea being, because they emphasize that mindfulness is not about the meditation. In fact, meditation or the thinking or the exercises are important. And the analogy they give, it's like going to the gym. When a person wants to be healthy, they go to the gym. But going to the gym doesn't make you healthy. Going to the gym is part of the process of being healthy. Being healthy is a state of being, right? So that's the concept. And the same thing is with mindfulness. So the exercise is like that intense boost that we go to a gym, but it's really to be able to inspire the rest of the day to live in a healthy way, and the same thing with mindfulness. Okay. Now what we're going to do today is take this a little bit deeper and have a deeper look at the concept of being fully aware of the present, being fully in the now. And we're going to share two ideas. The first one is going to be the main concept. And we're going to explore this idea. We're going to explore this idea of how one is, because being in the present means being fully in the present, in the experience of the now, and maximizing the potential means that you have to let go. You have to let go of the past and let go of the future, essentially, right? Because if you live the now full of the baggage of the past and the worries of the future, you can't experience the now. It's impossible. So when we talk about the amazing potential, the freshness or the infinite potential of every moment, there's a lot of letting go that has to happen, and we have to explore how that actually works. It's just a funny thing. Today, you know, this is a difficult thing. It's a lifelong process, right? I had this experience this morning, just before I sat down to actually finally do the final preparation for tonight's talk. Something happened this morning. It's not relevant what it was, but it was something that I was upset about. Something that I maybe inadvertently upset someone, or whatever the case was. And it was a thought that bothered me, and it was starting to niggle at me. And you know how that works. When something starts to bother you, it affects everything you're doing. And as God would have it, by divine providence, that's when I was sitting down to do the final mindfulness preparation for tonight's talk. And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. I've got to practice what I preach, right? So so I stopped. I closed whatever I was doing. And I just said, okay, let's try and experience what I'm about to share with you tonight, okay? It worked. And so, I'm not going to say it worked 100%, but it worked. It was pretty good. It was a liberating moment. Now we're going to do this by re-looking at the definition. Okay. So you remember that the definition of mindfulness actually had two parts to it, and this is the critical thing. The two parts was about being aware of the present, but then whenever you see mindfulness definition, it always talks about experiencing the now or paying attention to the present in a non-judgmental way. Okay. So those are the two concepts. Now, we pretty much understand the first idea. We talked about it a lot last week. So we understand that the present means the beginner's mind, the freshness, leaving the baggage behind, connecting to the moment, maximizing the infinite potential. That's what we spoke about till now. Okay. But when we talk about being non-judgmental, what does it actually mean? Right, we have to develop that and understand what that means, and particularly from a Jewish perspective. Because being non-judgmental is a problem. Right. The truth is that every moment of our life we make judgments. If we sit down to eat, even if we're going to eat very mindfully and be aware of what we're doing, we're making judgments. Is the food healthy or it's not healthy? Is it what I'm about to do, is it dangerous or not dangerous? We judge the taste of the food. We judge the enjoyment of the experience. We judge every moment. And very often that judgment is critical and beneficial and necessary. So what does it mean to be aware in the present in a non-judgmental way? Now, when you read the literature on mindfulness, so what starts to emerge in terms of translating this idea of being non-judgmental in a mindfulness context, they talk about accepting our thoughts. What does it mean, accepting our thoughts? It's what I told you before. You know, we all have thoughts that live in our brain, that live in our mind, that are distracting. And when we have thoughts that are distracting, they could be negative thoughts, they could be worrying thoughts, they could be exciting thoughts, they could be positive thoughts sometimes, and they could be positive thoughts that are distracting us away from experiencing the now, experiencing the present, right? Particularly when they're negative, particularly when they like it's worry or anxiety or jealousy, as an example, as we'll soon explore. So when they talk about experiencing the present in a non-judgmental way, what they mean is, what they talk about is, learning to accept those thoughts in a non-judgmental way, and to accept them, in other words, accept that they're there in a way that they won't distract us. What does that mean? What does it mean to accept them? So Dr. Kabat-Zinn, he said what that means is we distract ourselves from them, and he talks about not taking the thoughts personally. Okay. In other words, to see them as uninvited distractions, I accept that they're there, but I don't judge myself by them. I don't define myself by them. So what I do is, I completely distance myself from those thoughts. Okay? So we view them as completely uninvited, distracting thoughts. It doesn't define me. I don't judge myself by these thoughts. They might be very negative thoughts, but I learn not to judge myself by these thoughts. And the way the mindfulness literature says that we do that is we distance ourselves from the thoughts as if it's not my thoughts. It's got nothing to do with me. I learn to distance myself from those thoughts. Yeah, are we clear? So as an example, let's say we have jealousy. Jealousy is a problematic thought. It's a problematic emotion. People experience it. Empires fall because of jealousy. People fight because of jealousy. Subtle jealousy. Explicit jealousy, whatever the case is. Or a person can have thoughts of anger, hurt, resentment, worry. Right? All of those thoughts, if we leave them the way they are, what they do is they affect the present. They define the present. Often what happens is that I experience the now through the prism of those negative thoughts. In other words, the way I experience the present moment will be governed and guided and directed by those negative thoughts. My mood will be determined by those negative thoughts. The way your mood in a present moment will completely change and alter how you experience the moment. So if you have a thought of worry, and that guides and defines the now, then your whole now is a different experience. And your now is colored, your now is affected. It's not a fresh moment, it's not the beginner's mind. Okay? So therefore, what they talk about therefore is to learn to distance yourself from those thoughts. So although you have the thoughts, you accept that they're there, you completely disregard them. It's nothing to do with me, I don't personalize the thoughts at all. And therefore I'm able to give the moment a fresh moment. A fresh start. Because I make sure that the thought doesn't define what I'm doing now. Let me read to you, I'll put it on the screen, sort of the way it's put in some of the mindfulness literature, right? That the reason not judgment is used is because left alone, the brain will automatically judge things as good or bad, right or wrong, fair or unfair, important or unimportant, urgent or not urgent, and so on. This happens so fast, which is what happens to our brain, the way we experience thoughts, that our experiences are automatically colored right when we get to them. In other words, as soon as we experience a new experience, it's already affected by our thoughts, by our judgments. Okay? Because our thoughts make us judge the present moment in a particular way. So mindfulness is being aware of that and taking a fresh perspective. In other words, not letting our thoughts, not letting the negativity of our thoughts, which come from the past or perhaps from the future, judge the present moment. So we're able to look at the present moment completely fresh without allowing those thoughts to judge them at all. That's what not being aware in the present and non-judgmental actually means. However, it's not that simple. It's not that simple for the following reason. Because I want to test this theory, I want to test this idea, and look at it, this idea of divorcing ourselves from our thoughts. I want to kind of, first of all, how do we do that? How does it actually work, number one? And is it actually completely legitimate? Is that appropriate? Is that accurate, particularly from a Jewish perspective? So let me take you through a bit of a journey. In Jewish thought, we have a critical concept. And the critical concept goes like this. Mindfulness is very, very important in that every moment, we're supposed to live in the moment, be fully present in the now. However, the critical thing to understand is that we live in the moment, but not for the moment. Okay? Let me explain to you what that means, just to make it absolutely clear. There's a very, very important idea. Living for the moment means that I just live for this moment. I disregard the past, the future. It makes absolutely no difference to me. It almost becomes an experience where it doesn't matter what the present will do to tomorrow. It doesn't matter what happened in the past. I'm living life. I'm living life just for the now. That's living for the moment. But we don't live for the moment. We live in the moment. What's the difference? Because from a Jewish perspective particularly, life has a mission. Life has a purpose. And that purpose is an overall mission. There's a long-term mission statement by which we live. We have long-term values by which we live. We have meaning and purpose that we want to achieve throughout our journey through life, where we're able to experience life in such a way where we leave this planet in a completely different way than where we came in, and we've made a difference, right? So we have, although we need to live each moment freshly, we need to live in the moment and somehow detach ourselves from the past and the future, but we can't disregard the past and the future because we don't live for the moment, we live in the moment. Okay. Let me share a thought with you so it becomes a little bit clearer. You know, we have the festival of Pesach, Passover. And we know that there's one of the mitzvot, one of the commandments in the Torah, is that we count the Omer. Count Omer means from the second night of Pesach, we count 49 days of the Omer. It's a mitzvah, you count every night, 1, 2, 3, 4, until you get to 49. And the 50th day, we have the festival of Shavuot. Now there's a very fascinating halachic dispute, or halachic analysis on this mitzvah, which I'm just going to mention it in terms of the relevance of to this discussion. I'm not going to go through with you the halachic consequences of this discussion, because that's not relevant to this to what we're doing now. But there is a very fascinating halachic discussion in analyzing this mitzvah, to understand the nature of this mitzvah. And it's split among the great halachic authorities. Some believe that the 49 days of the Omer, each day is a separate mitzvah. Not one mitzvah, one collective mitzvah of counting all the 49 days, but each day is a separate mitzvah. So in other words, the halachic ramification would be if you forget one day, it doesn't affect the other day. Each day is a separate commandment. Right? There are those, however, that maintain, there are halachic authorities that maintain, that no, it's actually one complete mitzvah. And in order to fulfill that mitzvah, in order to achieve that mitzvah, you actually have to count all 49 days. Okay, that's the idea. Now again, this is a halachic discussion which has ramifications on various different halachic levels. But there's a philosophical angle to this concept, to this discussion. And that is that they're both correct. Because on one level, all the days of our life are one mitzvah, meaning the days of our life are one collective journey. It's one mission. We come into this world with a mission statement, with a goals, with objective, meaning, purpose, values, by which we're going to try and go through the journey of life and grow each day in that journey and try and maximize the potential of that journey and try to do the best we can so that we leave the world and ourselves and our soul in a better state when we finish our job. So that's the concept that it's all one. There is this one long mitzvah concept. That's one long idea. On the other hand, it is also true that every day is separate. One day has got nothing to do with the other day. Every day is a separate mitzvah. Every moment is a distinct moment. That's the concept of living in the moment. Not to worry about the overall mission. There is an overall mission, which we have to take into account. But each moment is a distinct moment. Each day is a separate mitzvah. And I share that with you because this becomes then the basis to try and understand how do we take into account the past and the future, which we have to do every day of our life. We can't disregard the yesterday. We can't forget about the challenges of tomorrow because it is one long journey, and at the same time live in the moment and not and detach ourselves somehow from the past and the future. So let me share with you a famous saying, a Hebrew saying, which works really good in Hebrew, but we're going to translate it as well. And it goes like this. Beautiful. It's an ancient Jewish saying. I'm not even 100% sure what the source is, but it's a very famous ancient Jewish saying. In fact, the singer Mordechai Ben David actually has a song to these words. Anyway, I won't sing it. That's not. And the saying goes the following. Ha'avar ayin, the past is no more. Ve'ha'atid adayin, atid in Hebrew is future. The future has not yet come. Ve'ha'hove keheref ayin, the present is only a fleeting moment. And therefore, da'aga minayin, where does the worry come from? So it's directed as people who worry a lot. And the saying goes, why are you worrying? The past is no longer here. The future hasn't yet come. The present is very short. So what are you worrying about? A nice idea. And it appears, right, this saying appears to fit right into the mindfulness concept. And to put it into the words of Dr. Kabat-Zinn, the mindfulness guru, he says, now is always the right time because now is the only time. Which is kind of what this is saying. In other words, just look at this moment as this is the only moment. Past is gone, the future hasn't come yet. It's a very small moment, so just live now. Live in the moment. So it's a great mindfulness line, and it seems like a great strategy, but it's not entirely true. Because the past is not gone, clearly. What happens in the past clearly has an effect on what we do now. The future is not just anticipated, but the future on one level is very much part of our present, and our present consciousness, and our present, the way we decide things, the way we make decisions, and it should be. Responsible people definitely take into account the future. So how do you do that? How do you live responsibly by connecting the past, the present, and the future, and yet living by this, living completely only in the moment? How does that work? How does those things go together? Right? So let me share with you a different saying that comes from the Ethics of the Fathers, which almost seems to contradict this, and we'll put them together and understand it, how it all works. And the saying goes like this. Who is wise? The Ethics of the Fathers says. Ezehu Chacham, who's wise? Haro'et ha-nolad, someone who sees the nolad. Nolad means the consequences of the future. In other words, the Ethics of the Fathers say, the teachings, the philosophical teachings, the life lessons that are brought down in the Ethics of the Fathers say, who is wise? A person who takes into account the consequences. We know that people who don't look at the consequences are people that do things wrong. People get into relationship problems, they say things, they do things because they don't take into account what that's going to lead to. They don't take into account the consequences, and therefore they're not thinking about the future. And therefore they just act instinctively, impulsively, and they mess things up. So who is wise? He who is able to see the nolad. Nolad in this context means the future. So how does that work? How does it go together? So here we have to just have a quick crash course in Hebrew language. Because in both sayings, the language is very different. Now the word in Hebrew for future is atid. Right? Atid? Even in modern Hebrew, it's atid. Here in this particular passage, which comes from the Ethics of the Fathers, the Mishnaic teachings, the author of this particular saying uses a very different language. Here, for some reason, we have a different word for future. The word is nolad. And nolad means consequences, it means future. But the literal translation of the word nolad is something that's going to be born. Something that is being born out of what I'm doing now. Right? When someone is born, it's like a birthday, it's called Yom Huledet. Same root. Right? See, here we don't say that who is wise, someone who sees the atid, someone who sees the future. But rather we use specifically the language, someone who sees the nolad, the consequences, what is happening in the future, but it's being born out of what is happening now. What does that mean? See, nolad means, it talks about the future, but it's the future which is happening now. It's being born now. The birth of that future is happening now. Why? Because you see, the future, there's two futures. If I'm doing something now, and I'm thinking about tomorrow, there's two kinds of tomorrow. Let's just go through this slowly so we get it clear. There's two kinds of tomorrow. There's a tomorrow, I don't mean tomorrow necessarily as tomorrow, it could be the next hour, but there's a future, right? So I'm just using the word tomorrow. There's a tomorrow which is completely out of my control. Now that's a critical concept. We need to know as human beings, we like to think we're in control, but we're not. As the Talmud tells us, a very, very famous saying, the Talmud says, everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven. What that means is that as human beings, we need, fundamental to Jewish belief particularly, is that everything is in the hands of God. That nothing happens from my doing. Everything happens that is in the hands of God. Everything is divinely planned. And everything that's going to happen tomorrow ultimately is in the hands of God, and I don't control anything that's out of me. except for one thing. I control my moral decisions. I control my responses to what is happening, which is part of moral living. So for example, just to give a simple example, if you get stuck on the way to a very, very urgent meeting in a very, very big traffic jam and your mobile battery dies, and you're completely stuck and it's hot and your air conditioning isn't working and you're frustrated, that is completely out of your control. We get angry because we think it's in our control. And some of you have heard me say before that this problem has gotten worse because today we live in the world of technology where we think, because technology is so effective, we think we're in control. And if you don't believe me, and some of you heard me say this before, stand in a big, tall, high-rise building and watch people come to the lift. Busy, they're in a rush. And they press the button and the lift doesn't come instantaneously. What do? They press it again. Now, you don't have to be an electrical engineer to know that it's not going to help. Right? But people, because we've so gotten used to being in control that if we flick a button that, you know, we can broadcast on WhatsApp to thousands of people instantaneously and we can affect by remote control who knows what. So we come to we've erroneously started to think that we're really in control and we're not. So therefore, a chutzpah, you know, I come to the lift and I push the thing, it doesn't come. What do you mean? I push the button, it has to come. So I push it again, right? The same thing people do at a traffic light. You see that people, you know, keep pressing the green button because they think it's going to work faster. It doesn't work faster. We know that, right? So there's a large part of the tomorrow that is completely not in my control. Okay? So getting back to the traffic jam, we think we're in control. So we're actually not in control. If I get stuck in a traffic jam, I was meant to get stuck in a traffic jam. It's God's plan. What I am in control of is, how I respond to that traffic jam. Do I start swearing? Do I start getting angry? Do I start getting frustrated? Or do I take it as an opportunity to live as a better moral person, to keep calm, to control my anger, not to scream at my kids in the car, or whatever the case is, right? So, am I going to do something meaningful with the moment, or I'm gonna mess up the moment? So, there is a tomorrow, there is a future that I'm completely not in control of. But there's a future, there's a tomorrow that I am in control of. And that's my moral living, my value-based living. In other words, what I do now from a moral point of view, my actions that I take now, the things that I say now, the decisions I make now, definitely affect what happens in the future. Because I am in control of my moral living. Right? So there's things I do now that responsible or irresponsible, moral or immoral, that will have an effect on my relationships, have an effect on who I am, what kind of person I am, will have an effect on what happens tomorrow in terms of consequences of my moral decisions. Those things I'm in control. That's the future, that's the tomorrow that I'm in control of now. So the way it works is like this. Give me one second. The way it works is like this. There's the atid and then there's nolad. The atid is the future that I'm not in control of. The nolad is the future that I am in control of. Yes.
You're not also in control of your effort that you put in.
Yeah, but the effort you put in now, but not necessarily what's going to happen in the future is, in other words, yeah, God, the reason that we put in effort is because that's a moral thing to do. God wants us to live responsibly. So if we put in the effort, how that effort is going to then translate into the blessing I get is not necessarily determined by my effort. That's God's business. Which is a whole other discussion, which we probably will be a digression if we're willing. Okay. So, in the words of a great sage by the name of a 5th century sage, by the name of the 15th century sage, the Rabbi Shimon Bar Tzemach Doron, the Rashbetz, he said the following. He said, because a person should think about the future and do what he can do to save himself from evil, and that which is not in his control, he should have confidence in God and not worry about it. In other words, worry about the future that is in your control, let go of the future that is not in your control. Or, to share with you the words of an Alcoholics Anonymous prayer in the 12-step program, which says, God grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay. I'm going to give out these slides at the end, so if you want to take them away, you could. In other words, what this means is as follows. We understand that we do have an impact on the future, right? And it does guide what we do now. We do plan. We don't live in for the moment. There's an overall mission. And definitely what I do now, I take into account the consequences of the future. I take into account what I'm going to do. I take into account the stuff that I could affect in the future that is in my control, that God has given me the ability to change and to have an impact on. But it doesn't cause me anxiety. I don't worry. Because worrying is about things that I cannot control. Does that make sense? We worry about things we cannot control. We don't worry about things we could control. Because the things we could control, we can control now. You see, the part of the future that I can control is not an unknown. The part of the future that I control is a direct consequence of what I do now. So I don't have to worry about that. I have to make the right decision now. The part of the future that I worry about tomorrow, and by the way, this is in all things, even in matters, let's say, God forbid, someone is unwell. So we have, in Jewish thinking, we have this concept called bitachon. Bitachon means to believe and to trust in God that things will turn out okay. Does that mean we just fully trust and we sit back and we don't do anything, we don't go to a doctor, we don't make medical decisions? Of course not. Because that's contrary to moral living. Moral living means to live responsibly. Living responsibly means you need to make decisions in your control that will affect, hopefully, in a positive way, the future. So I need to seek good medical advice. I need to make good decisions. I need to make proper decisions. That's the part I can control now, and that's what I need to do now. That's not an unknown. The decisions I make now, I know what I can make. I know what I can do. How it turns out, that's the unknown. That's what I start to worry. But how it turns out is not in my control. That's the part I got to divorce myself from. That's the part I got to let go. The problem is, with human beings, the problem is what we do often is we reverse this whole thing. Right? We don't worry, we don't address the stuff that is in our control, and instead we choose to worry about the stuff that is not in our control. That's what happens so often. And that's why the anxiety of the future so affects the present. Because instead of focusing our full attention to be fully present in the now and to maximize the now in the greatest, most meaningful and purposeful way and to make the best decisions I can make now in a calm and trusting way, in a non-judgmental way, instead of that, we leave that alone and we worry about tomorrow. We bring the tomorrow, we bring the atid into the now. That's the problem. Not the nolad. The nolad, the nolad is what we do now and how it affects the future. But what we do is we bring the atid into the now. We bring the stuff that's the future of tomorrow that we cannot control, that is completely out of our control. We bring that into the now and that affects the present. Okay? Let's talk about a similar concept about the past. It's also an interesting thing how that works. So, the past is a little bit different, but it works in a very, very similar way. You see, in Jewish thinking, we cannot just throw away the past. We cannot divorce ourselves from the past. Why? Because as human beings, we need to make amends. As human beings, if we make mistakes, we need to take responsibility for those mistakes. Very soon in the Jewish calendar, we're coming up to the month of Elul. The month of Elul is well known as the month before Rosh Hashanah. It's known as the month of stock taking. It's known as the month where we prepare for the concept of what we call tshuva. Tshuva means repentance, return, reconnection, repairing. Right? And God has given us that opportunity to do what? God has given us the opportunity to do the following. To take stock of the past, to take responsibility for our mistakes, but He's given us the ability to fix those mistakes. Right? To fix those mistakes. So we cannot just throw away the past. So what does it mean, ha'avar ayin? What does that song mean, that the past is gone? The past is not gone. The past has to come with us. Because we need to take responsibility for the things that we do from the past, so we can learn from the past, we can make amends for the past, we can learn from the mistakes that we've done and fix them and ask for forgiveness or learn from them or improve on them and so on and so forth, as growing human beings do. Right? But the way it works is as follows. Again, it's a control issue. You see, when we take responsibility for the past, we carry the past into the present as much as we need to take responsibility for the past. But we don't let the past control us. We don't let the past define the present. Because our mistakes that we made yesterday don't define me. They don't define who I am, and they don't define the present moment. The present moment is fresh. The present moment is pure. The present moment is a new breath. It's a new neshama. It's a new expression of our soul, of the purity of the soul, as we spoke about last week. But in that purity of the moment, what we also have to do, part of the potential of the present moment, part of the potential of the now, is to learn from the past and take those things from the past and work with them. But not let the past control the now. There's a very similar concept written in the book of Tanya. The book of Tanya was written by the first Chabad Rebbe, Rav Shnei Zalman of Ladin. And he talks in one of the chapters about the idea of guilt. Now, as Jews, this is a very good subject because guilt is one of our specialities. Right? And there's often the discussion, is guilt a good thing or a bad thing? So the truth is that it's not true to say guilt is a completely bad thing. On one hand, it is. Guilt is very destructive. Guilt can be paralyzing, it can be debilitating. People who walk around with guilt are dysfunctional people. The more guilt, the more dysfunction. On the other hand, if a person never has guilt, you never grow. Why? Because if you don't feel any sense of guilt for the past, then you feel completely comfortable with where you are, you'll never grow. You become complacent. So in order to grow, part of the process of growth requires a certain aspect of guilt, a certain aspect of reflecting on the past and feeling uncomfortable. So how does that work? Is guilt a good thing or a bad thing? And he presents a very simple formula. And the formula is that guilt is a good thing as long as I control the guilt. As soon as guilt starts to control me, it's a problem. In other words, he recommends there, in fact, he says you need to have designated times to feel guilty. What does that mean? In other words, when you walk around, you just can't get the guilt out of your head, and what did I do, what did I say, and I made a mistake, and I'm nothing, and I'm silly, and I don't know, people are looking at me bad, all this kind of stuff. The guilt is controlling you, it's out of control, you can't control it. It's a destructive, bad thing, because the guilt, the past, is defining the present. As soon as the past defines you or the present moment, it doesn't work. But I'm in control of the guilt, in other words, I have the past, I take into account the past, but I don't let it define me, because I control when I reflect on the past. I don't walk around the whole day thinking of my mistakes. I have certain times when I say, you know what? And this is something that went through my mind this morning as I was experiencing what I said to you before. I said, that's fine. Yes, okay, it might have been a mistake that I made. So I'm going to talk about it right now. I'm preparing a thing for tonight. So it's out, finished. I'm not worrying about it. It doesn't define who I am. It doesn't make me a bad person just because I made a mistake. But maybe later on when I'm finished preparing the lecture, I'm going to sit down in 15 minutes and work out what I did, if it was a mistake. And if it is, I'll fix it. So it's a controlled thing, right? So we do take into account the past. We take responsibility for the past. But we don't let the past define the present or define us. So, there's a great passage from one of the great sages called Rabbeinu Yonah, when he talks about the concept of Tisha B'Av. He says, on the day a person repents, he should cast away all of his sins and consider himself as if he's born that day, having neither the merit nor sin, and the day is the beginning of his deeds. It's a fresh moment. Because a person does it in a controlled way. He controls the past. He makes amends, take responsibility, but it creates a freshness. He doesn't let the past define who he is. So let's go back now to the concept of being in the present in a non-judgmental way. Let's go back to our thoughts of jealousy, just as an example. It can be anything. It can be thoughts of resentment, thoughts of worry. So there's different approaches. Okay. Let me share with you a model that a writer called Jonathan Feiner, who wrote an article, he's a doctor in the States, a PhD, and he wrote an article on Jewish mindfulness. And he brings this idea and he says there's three approaches. So I'm plagued by a thought of jealousy, or I'm plagued by a thought of worry or anxiety or resentment or hatred or being offended or whatever the case is, and I'm walking around the whole day with this thought, and I know it's disturbing and distracting my ability to be in the present moment, right? We all have these experiences on some level. So there's three approaches. One is to be judgmental about it. In other words, we let that thought completely define the present, and therefore it makes the present dysfunctional. It makes us the present negative. It doesn't allow us to experience the moment, because everything we're experiencing in the present moment is being colored and affected negatively by those thoughts. So that's obviously a negative thing. That's not going to work. And then there's the third way, the second way, sorry, and that's being non-judgmental, which is the typical mindfulness concept. That's saying, distance ourselves from the thought, it's not my thought, I don't have to worry about it, I distance myself completely from that thought. And he submits that that's not the correct way either, particularly from a Jewish point of view, but he suggests a third model, and that's what we've been talking about over here, and that's the third model, which he calls judgmental but compassionate. In other words, we do take responsibility for the thought. The thought is our thought. If I'm feeling jealous, it's a problem. Jealousy is not a good thought to have, and it means that I have some self-reflection and some character development to engage in, and I need to work with it. So I don't distance myself completely from the thought, because if I'm feeling feelings of hurt or resentment or hatred or whatever I'm feeling, that is a problem, and I need to. It is my thought, and I need to take responsibility for it. But I need to do it, as he calls it, in a compassionate way, which means I aspire to get rid of it. I aspire to deal with it. I don't let it define me. I don't let it control me. But I do plan. I do bring it into the present because I do work with it to try and distance myself from it in a way where I work with it, how not to become jealous, how to forgive, how not to be hurtful, so that I can become a better person. In other words, I use these thoughts as a gauge to where I am in my own personal growth. I use these thoughts in a way where I can work with them, take responsibility for them, and improve on them. It's not going to happen overnight. If I'm an angry person, I'm not going to stop being angry tomorrow. If I lose my temper very often, to think that I might stop losing my temper from tomorrow morning will work, only for 5 minutes. But, right, it won't work. It won't work a long time. But I can improve. I can lose my temper less next week than this week. I can hate less next week than this week. I can worry less next week than this week. I can use this. In other words, I won't let the thought debilitate me. I won't let the thought define me. I won't let it control me. I won't let it affect the present negatively. But I won't distance myself completely from it either, because I need to take responsibility for it. So therefore, just putting it into sort of a nutshell and summarizing it, what that means is as follows. Mindfulness means to be fully present in the now, to live in the moment. To live in the moment fully, to understand this moment is the most important moment, because this is what I'm doing now has absolute value. And I need to experience it in a totally fresh way, understand its infinite opportunity, and maximize the potential that is given to me in this moment. I need to do it, as mindfulness says, in a non-judgmental way, but from a Jewish perspective, what that means is that I don't disregard completely the past or the future. I disregard the future, the atid. I disregard the future, that future that I cannot control. And I disregard the past that wants to control me in the present. So that's a very, very important process to go through, to let go of the past that's controlling me, to let go of the future that I cannot control. And by the way, giving up control is one of the most difficult things that human beings find. It's one of the most difficult tasks to do. You know why? Because God created us with a need to control. Why did He do that? That was unfair. He did it for a very important reason. He did it because human beings need to control. We need to control ourselves. Self-control. The problem with us is that we often channel that need to control into controlling everything else but ourselves. Right? But the concept of control is a very good concept. The problem is we just need to know where it needs to be placed. So giving up control of that which I cannot control is very difficult, but I need to channel it in self-control. And self-control is to take hold of the moment and to let go of that which I cannot control. Let go of those things that are trying to control me. But nevertheless, at the same time, not to distance myself completely, because we don't live for the moment, we live in the moment, and there is a mission, and the past is important, and the future is important. But only that, it's only important as much as I can affect it in the now. So I don't let the past define the now, I don't let the future define the now, but I use the now to take responsibility for the past, to fix the past, to improve on the past, and I use the now to make good decisions that hopefully will affect the future. But I don't let the past or the future define me. And that's what mindfulness really is, particularly from a Jewish perspective, to live fully in the moment and not let the past or the future define this, and yet affect the past and the future, but in a way that doesn't define the present at all, and that the present remains a completely fresh moment. Now, just to take this one step further, When you, you know, we do many things. When we talk about being present in the now, right? There are many, there's a series of nows in the day, right? You get up in the morning, we do millions of things through the day. In normal life, some of these things are more important or less important, correct? So, when you go to, there are things that we call an end and things we call means to an end, right? So, you get up in the morning, you've got to go to an appointment, you get in the car and there's a long drive to the appointment. So the appointment is the important part. The drive there is a means to an end. I don't know, there's a mess in the room, you've got to clean it up. That's a means to an end. No one has tremendous enthusiasm in cleaning up clutter, right? So there's many, many things that we spend a lot of time during the day doing things that really are not important. We do them because we have to. We do them because we want to get to a certain point. Okay. However, that is not completely true. And this is a very, very important idea that has such an impact on how we live every moment to its fullest. In Jewish mindfulness, we have a concept like this. Let me tell you a little story. There was a great Hasidic Rebbe called the Kotzker Rebbe. The Kotzker Rebbe was known as a great Hasidic Rebbe. He was very sharp and witty, and there's a lot of short sayings that are well known from him. And he was such an interesting individual that towards the end of his life, the last 10 years of his life, he actually went into isolation. He went into his room and he spent most of his time alone, studying, praying, whatever the case is. And the story goes that once in a while he would emerge from his room and he would like come into the shul or the place where people were learning. And he would say something very short, like a little lesson or something, or ask a question, and he would go back into his room. That's the Kotzker Rebbe, very unique individual. One time he came out, and everyone sort of was pleased to see him, came out of his room, walked into the shul, there were people sitting there learning, and he said, "Ich verstehe nicht, ich verstehe nicht, I don't understand. Someone says to him, "What don't you understand?" He says, "The Rambam says, Maimonides says, that when you pray, you have to have kavana. You have to have intention. You have to have focus. I don't understand that." And he went back into his room. So everyone was completely baffled. I mean, it's every five-year-old child knows that when you make a blessing or you pray, praying is good even if you don't have focus, even if you just say the words. But if you have focus, it's much better. If you say the Amidah, you say a prayer and you know who you're talking to and you're focused and you have a bit of intention and feeling, obviously it's a much better prayer. What is so difficult to understand that Maimonides tells us that when you pray, you have to have kavanah, you have to have focus. And we said last week, kavanah is the Jewish translation of mindfulness. It's lechavein, to direct our mind, not to be distracted by other things and to be fully focused. So I couldn't understand. What did he mean? What did he mean, I don't understand? So eventually someone got to him, either went into his study or they waited for the next time he came out or whatever the case is. And they said to him, "What didn't you understand about the law that says that when you pray, you have to have kavanah?" He said, "I'll tell you what I don't understand," he says. "Praying you have to have kavanah. Everything you have to have kavanah. Everything you do, you have to have kavanah." What did he mean? See, from a Jewish perspective, when you live a life that's called a value-based life, right? We live a life that's based on values. What that really means, the Talmud tells us, is that a real value-driven life is a life where everything that we do is consistent with our values. Which means, living a life, a godly life, doesn't mean only praying or doing mitzvot or lighting Shabbos candles or doing spiritual things, experiencing spiritual experiences. But Jewish values or Torah values are values that guide every single part of living, including taking care of our health and having a break and recreation. Whatever we do, there's a value that directs what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And not always it's black and white. Sometimes you have to explore. Sometimes it's a bit gray. But whatever the case is, there are values that are the basis of everything we do in life, and everything we do in life should be based on those values. Right? And that's part of living a life of meaning and purpose. That means that every part of the day, we're living our life consistent with good values. Which means that whatever we do, it's either consistent with our values, then it's important. If it's not consistent with our values, we shouldn't be doing it. And this could be eating, it could be sleeping, it could be doing business, it could be recreation, whatever it is. All these things can be done in a way where it's consistent with values, and that's great. But if it's not consistent with, if it's inconsistent with the values, it shouldn't be really happening. Which means the following. That from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective, there actually is no such thing as a means to an end. That concept doesn't exist. Because every moment that we live, everything that we do, has to have a purpose. And even if its superficial purpose is to get to a particular place, but because what we're doing now can have value, can have meaning and purpose, what we're doing now is as important as the goal. The journey is as important as the destination. Very fundamental Jewish concept. That whatever a person does, they can be growing as a human being from what they're doing. Let's take the example we said before. If you're driving to an appointment in heavy traffic, so it's a means to an end, but you can drive based on values. It's how you react to the traffic. It's how you talk. It's the things you do. It's the things you listen to. It's the way you communicate to the people in the car. Everything that we can do based and driven and inspired by good values and purpose and meaning. There's nothing that we experience. That's what the Kotzkleber was asking. Okay, there's answers to his question, but essentially what he was asking is that everything needs full focus because everything we do in life has meaning and purpose. And that's mindfulness at a deeper level. Because when we say that the now, right? Value-based living means that every moment is the most important moment. Why is it the most important moment? Because everything we do, we can grow as a human being. Everything we do, we can increase and emphasize and nurture our values. Everything we do, we can bring our values that we live by and make me a better person in what I'm doing now. Doesn't matter if I'm washing dishes or changing nappies or paying taxes or whatever the case is. All the things we don't like to do, which we see as necessary evils. Right? The bathroom breaks down and you got to stay home and call a plumber. And you're late for the office. Right? So that's out of our control. It's divinely designed. It's hard to believe sometimes, but yeah, okay, it is. And we just got to get over it. So most people look at it as a necessary evil. Very difficult to do that mindfully. But from a Jewish mindfulness perspective, it should become very easy. If that's what God designed for me to happen today, that's what happened. There's so much I can do in that moment. I can remain calm. I can work with my character. I can not let myself get upset. I can treat the plumber with respect. I can do something maybe meaningful in the meantime. I can get to something I didn't get. There's so much I can do while I'm waiting to get over what I would normally consider this necessary evil. So there's no means to an end. Because everything I do, even if it's a journey, the journey is as important. And we achieve just as much with the journey as we do with the destination. Right? And that's the second part of living in the moment. So it's letting go of the future that I cannot control, letting go of the past that wants to control and define the present, take responsibility for the past, impact the future, yes, take into account, it's one long journey, but letting go of the stuff that's going to define and negatively impact on the present moment and live it to the fullest. But when we add to the equation this concept that the moment, what I'm doing now, if it's based on my values, it's as important as anything else, then that moment truly becomes the most important moment, even if it's a menial task, even if it's a journey, even if it's a means to an end, because if I'm doing it now, that's what I'm meant to be doing now, that's what's making me grow as a human being, that's my divine mission in the present moment, and therefore becomes the absolute most important moment of my life, until I get to the next fresh moment. And that's why I approach that moment as a fresh moment, as a moment of infinite opportunity, as a moment where I can maximize great potential and I live it to the fullest. In the moment, not for the moment, in the moment in the context of my overall life mission, my life of values and purpose, and my life of values. So that's the concept of living in the now. Next week, we're going to talk about the exercises and the meditations and the things that we do in the mindfulness process that help us get to this point and help us learn to focus on the moment. Have a great week. Oh, the PowerPoint slides are here. If anyone wants to take them, please help yourself.